everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have a goodie for you guys today. Today I have a Renaissance man, a guy, I hope, wait till you hear him talk. I'm going to have to whip him from afar to get in, to do the right thing. But he is an author, Joseph Egan, and he wrote an amazingly great book called The Purple Diaries, Mary Astor and the Most Sensational Hollywood Scandal of the 1930s. It is a great book. I read it twice. And here is our Renaissance man and talker, Joseph. Joe, welcome.
Glad to be on your show.
I'm glad to be talking to you. Yes, I feel that we kind of know each other because we've emailed back and forth, you know, because of snowstorms, we've had delays.
I think it's three at this point.
Yes, you got bam. I love you. You use brouhaha a lot in your book. I love that. It's one of my favorite words. So, Joe, tell the audience and tell me, what got you interested? Because this book is about the mayor. Tell us what the book's about and how you got interested in making it.
All right. In 1936, there was a very famous custody trial in the summer of 1936, and it basically wiped everything off the papers that summer. I mean, in Germany, you had the Olympics, you had the Spanish Civil War, but Gone with the Wind had just been released, but nobody was reading about that. They were reading about this trial. And what this trial was about was that actress Mary Astor had the year before divorced her husband, and because he had threatened her with publishing her private diary, which contained her most intimate secrets, it contained also the most intimate secrets of her friends, because he threatened to publish it, she gave him custody of their three-year-old daughter, Marilyn. During the next year, what occurred was that the father became more controlling. He became more physically abusive to the child. He diminished her role as mother, and she was seeing that there would be permanent damage to the child, and so she made a decision that if she lost her movie career, so be it. If she was embarrassed in front of the public, so be it. Pillot, I think, was the term they used. So she went to trial in July of 1936, and she sought to have custody restored to her. The press got wind of the diary and of the salacious nature of the diary, and it just blew up into this massive story that just dominated the press. It matched the O.J. Simpson trial. It matched the Michael Jackson trial. It was simply a massive story, and it got forgotten. And what got me interested in it was I was doing conceptual collages, mm-hmm. and I wanted to do one on the history of Hollywood from the 1920s all the way to the 1990s to show essentially things hadn't really changed. And so of all the pieces that I did one or two of them, but I never did the Mary Astor piece, but of all of them, this interested me the most. And it interested me the most because it was never really reported properly. No books had been written on it. The sections of other books on it were basically just all – they were not true. They were simply not true. And so I wanted to get the story down, and I wanted to get it right. And finally, I read an article, I think it was in New York Magazine, and it based itself on a book called Hollywood Babylon, which was totally – sensationalized and absolutely untrue, and I felt that if I didn't do something, that this story, you know, they would rely on things like Hollywood Babylon to tell this story, which wasn't true, and I wanted to have something out there that told the true story. And I also, in learning all this, I also came to admire Mary Astor a great deal, and I felt her story should be told properly because it was a very courageous act.
It really was, and so you actually got in touch with her daughter to tell her you were going to write the book. She wasn't too happy, but...
But see, Marilyn's a very interesting person. Marilyn is Marilyn Anson did a great job raising Marilyn, although Marilyn will disagree. Marilyn felt that she didn't want all, you know, her mother to be put in a bad light and this or that and just dredge all this stuff up. But she said, if you're going to do it, you know, I'll help you do it because at least you'll do it right. And so she gave me, we never talked on the phone. We did it all through emails, and she gave me something like 50,000 words of material. Yeah, she's an extraordinary woman. She's in her late 80s, and she reads philosophy, metaphysics. I mean, she's an extraordinary woman, extraordinary woman.
And she became your friend.
Oh, very close. Yes.
So did
other members of the family.
Yes.
Some of the kids in New York came up, the grandkids, great-grandkids came up to visit.
How cool.
I'm friendly with Mary Astor's grandchildren, at least the three daughters, two daughters. And in fact, one of the granddaughters said, I'm really a member of the family, sort of a distant cousin.
That's really nice because they gave you access to a lot of stuff. And the person that wrote the foreword to the book, that's her grandson, right?
That's Andrew. Andrew was in New York at the time. Now he's in L.A., and he and his aunt Gabrielle basically are the only ones in the family that have real interest in Mary Astor, and so they collect the material and they keep the legend going. Most of the family just have moved on.
Yeah, well, they gave you some great stuff and some great photos. Oh my God, first one I saw.
I have to tell you that I had 300 photos. The publisher went crazy and said, look, we'll give you 80, but not 300. So I have tons. I think I have everything on the trial. I collected over a period of about 4 years.
Wow.
And stuff. It's, I have an amazing amount of material. I may put it out as an e-book.
You should, or do something like that, because you have all that material. Also, I found it very interesting that, I'm losing my train of thought. We're talking about them. You became their friends. They gave you all the stuff. But you know a picture I just loved? I've never seen this picture. It's when they're doing Red Dust, and there's Gene Harlow, and you see the director. And then there's that great picture of Clark Gable and Mary Astor just watching the whole thing. I love that picture.
I hunted for that picture because Andrew had written the intro, and he didn't mention that picture. He was talking about another one. But he mentioned seeing pictures of them on the set and this and that and this and that. And so there was another one where they were sort of outside the studio, you know, in between takes. Mm-hmm. But I looked for that one, and that one I thought was just fabulous.
Oh, I loved it. It is what a great picture.
If you want, I'll send you a scan.
I love it. I just was like, wow. And I want to, I'll put it on the website and also on my Facebook page because it's a great picture.
I'll send you a high-res scan.
So terrific.
You can reproduce it.
That'd be great. Also, you write it sort of in three books, the three parts. There's the before, the trial, and then the after. So why don't you talk a little bit about Mary's history prior to her going to the trial?
You've just opened the door, but I'll try to keep this brief. she was born in Quincy, Illinois. Her father was a teacher. Her mother was a teacher. But her father was just, he was what we would call today a borderline personality disorder. And he was domineering and controlling and delusions of grandeur. Anyway, she had won a sort of a picture contest. And he said, ha ha, I have money here.
Yeah.
And they went to New York, and they, you know, through a lot of difficulties, they managed to get, Astor managed to get a contract with, I'm not sure if it was in New York or if it was in L.A., but anyway, she got a contract with I think it was Jesse Lasky, but I'm not sure about that. And so her career began. At 16, she was just gorgeous.
And, oh, my God.
John Barrymore, she really started when she was 14, but she was 16.
But she looked a lot older, too. She looked a lot older.
He was 40. But yeah. John Barrymore was what we would call today a dirty old man. And he liked them young, and he liked to seduce them.
Well, she was a tender morsel. She was also a virgin, wasn't she?
Oh, no question. With those parents?
Yes.
Yeah, there was no question about that. They watched her doggedly. I mean, they didn't let her have any friends. She was their meal ticket. She was making like $3,000 a week, and they were living in a mansion. In any case, Barrymore saw a photograph of her and asked for her to be in a film of his, which was a major Warner Brothers production called Bo Brummel. Now, at the time, Barrymore was considered the one of the greatest stage actors. He had done the famous Hamlet, and so it was a coup for Warner Brothers to have him. And he was making a lot of money. It was a big picture, and he saw it, and he had a screen test with her, and he immediately fell in love with her. And they carried on an affair hidden from the parents for the next 2 years until he couldn't get past her parents, and she wouldn't break away from her parents. He wanted to take her to London to play the lead part in Richard III? I can't remember. He wanted to catapult her into a great actress.
Right.
She was there. But her parents saw her as a meal ticket, and they stage money and movie money there was a great disparity, and so they refused, and she refused to marry him because she was scared, and so he just said he just had enough one day, and he fell in love with he met Dolores Costello, fell in love, they got married, and to her dying day, John Barrymore was her great love. She kept. I still have copies of all the telegrams.
Oh, wow. I'd love to see those.
And they sent. It was amazing. It was really amazing.
Well, that's pretty big when you're a little girl and your first love is John Barrymore.
Exactly. That's
huge.
How she felt. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that's huge. I mean, what a start you get in life. You get a really good guy.
She felt this great man. Mm-hmm. You know, this great man loved her. Mm-hmm. So, because she had no real sense of self or a sense of self worth,
right? Because they didn't give her any.
Way her father treated her. I mean, everything she did was wrong. You'll do what I say.
And
suddenly,
no affection from her family.
Oh, none whatsoever. Yeah. None whatsoever.
And none between them. At all,
and also, you know, to a certain degree, her mother was jealous because she was getting all the attention.
She's beautiful,
awful childhood.
Yeah,
and she didn't want her daughter to have an awful childhood, so that's why she went to court. So she had the affair with Barrymore, and then after that, and this is really tragic. She saw other men. She was engaged, unengaged, and she met Ken Hawks, who was Howard Hawks, the famous director's brother. And Howard really loved her, accepted her for who she was, and for the first time in her life, she was really loved for who she was. And they got married, and she didn't have to act if she didn't want to. He didn't live off her money. The money went to her parents, and then he died tragically in a plane crash.
That was
in 1930, and she was totally devastated. And I think for the rest of her life, never recovered. And then she got sick. She got tuberculosis. She met this doctor. The doctor took care of her, kept it quiet, and eventually, you know, in her mind, she saw him as someone to protect and save her, and married him. And that was Dr. Thorpe. And they eventually had the child together in 1932 in Marilyn. And then, you know, I think 1935 they were divorced, and you had the custody trial in 1936.
But in between, I mean, they both were unfaithful to one another.
Oh, and Marilyn often says her father would have made a great polygamist. I mean, he had two, three girlfriends at the same time, and they got along with
each other. That's so funny. I read once.
He was one of his best friends was Clark Gable, and I always say, you know, Clark Gable was really a mama's boy in real life. Mm-hmm. And he always wanted these women to take care. But Franklin Thorpe was what Clark Gable projected on the screen in terms of masculinity. Although he was shorter and stuff, but they were hunting buddies. They were very, very close friends.
Yeah, for years. So he had the affairs, but the big thing is Mary kept a diary, and she had this huge thing with Kaufman?
With George Kaufman. But let me just correct you. It wasn't a diary. It was really diaries. She had a diary during her marriage to Ken.
Right.
And then after he died, she started another one when she started up with Thorpe. And that was the second. So there were really two. That's why it's called the Purple Diaries.
Yes.
Everybody says the diary, but it wasn't. And you were asking me. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was saying how she had this humongous love affair with her dreamboat, who she thought was swell, George Kaufman.
All right. George Kaufman was the Neil Simon of his day. He was the most successful playwright. But Kaufman and his wife did not have marital relations after their first baby, stillborn baby, was born. And so Kaufman, who was, if you see pictures of him, was a very homely-looking
Yuck,
guy.
I saw pics. Ugh.
Kaufman decided to learn how to be a great lover.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He went to prostitutes to learn how to find out what women wanted in bed.
Mm-hmm.
He went with actresses to find out what women wanted to hear. He learned that flowers, telegrams, opening doors, lighting cigarettes.
Telling them how beautiful they are.
Making them feel like they were as intelligent as he was. He was a great seducer, but it was very quiet outside of Broadway. Astor went to New York and she met him. Within a week, they started up, and the affair lasted it started in 33,
mm-hmm.
and went on through to 35, to the end of 35.
Mary waxed poetic about that in her diary.
In fact, after Astor, one of the actresses he took up with was Louise Rhina. So, the list is just extraordinary.
There had to be something.
That Thorpe read the diary one day, before the divorce, and he read the chapters about Kaufman, and she's kind of comparing him to Kaufman. Thorpe was like a drip, he's boring, it's a story for him, but George, he gives me happiness beyond measure. He is the greatest,
pleasure.
So Thorpe read that, and shall we say, it was Vesuvius erupting, and you give me a divorce on my terms, I make this all public, I get custody, I get control of all the money, what he did was simply atrocious. But then on the other hand, what she did to him wasn't exactly
wasn't a piece of cake. And also, Jesus, don't do diaries. Who would do?
Nobody could understand why anybody would keep such candid diaries.
I used to do journals, and I tossed them. I'm like, I don't want anyone to ever see this stuff, and I'm not famous.
Yeah. I kept a diary once, and I read it a few years later, and I said, I don't want anybody to read this.
Really?
I feel like an idiot.
Yes, I felt like an idiot reading my own. I said, I make me
and
sick.
She said she kept it because she would reread it. It allowed her to keep her thinking straight. You have to understand, in the house that she grew up, there was no consistency. Whatever mood her father was in, it was like a war zone.
Yeah.
So she would write her thoughts down, read them over, be able to understand. You know what I mean? She used it as a tool, but again, it didn't serve her very well in the end.
No. And then he read it.
And the other thing is, she always wanted to be a writer, and it wasn't until she did a biography in 1958. Or autobiography that she began to write, and she liked it so much that she eventually gave up acting and wrote a series of successful novels until a stroke and health problems stopped. And she wasn't able to write after that.
Right. So what we're getting to now is the fact that he also, her husband, but he was seeing other women as well. But I think reading that is a killer. But
and the thing was that he saw this other woman, and what was her name?
That was at Damon, Florida.
Lillian.
His common-law wife.
and yes. That was the other thing about the common. Read the book for that one because that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing was that he would basically see Lillian was very mothering. He was very very mothering. You read about Prince Philip. And that Camilla Boyles was very mothering.
But he wanted to be her tampon. How's that her mothering?
What Lillian did was she accepted him. She accepted that he was promiscuous, and she accepted he would never marry her. And she gave him the emotional support that he really needed. He had been raised he was very close to his mother when he was younger.
Yeah.
So she gave him. Astor couldn't do that. Astor was very hard. She was brutal. She was brutal on herself as an actress. She was brutal on herself as a person, which stemmed from how she was raised. Her father was brutal. She was very brutal on Marilyn. Marilyn was growing up. Her mother was very strict and very tough. A mother's word was law. And so Astor was so tough on herself, she was obviously tough on her husband.
Well, the whole thing...
You couldn't deal with that.
But the thing with Mary was, I think you hit it, and I think you said it in a thing, that Mary Astor was in love with love, but she really didn't know how to be loved or love. She just wanted to feel, and once the oomph or the zoomph went out of a relationship, she was done.
I mean, you know, as I like to say, when you get together the first time, it's like, you know, you see the, it's like she's like a flower, he's like a flower, all right? But then, you know, you get married, and the petals fall off, and then you then it's a seed pod. And you've got to adjust to that, that they're there for, she could never do that. She wanted romance.
Always.
Her romance is everything. And that stemmed back to Barrymore. And the only person she found more than that with was Ken Hawkes. But he was an exceptional person. He was truly an exceptional person.
He looked great. And she also cheated on him and got pregnant.
And he found out, and he went into a tailspin, and she said, I can never do this again. I can never hurt this man again. And she realized, you know, the cost it was to him and this and that. He wasn't as sexual as she was. He, you know, his libido was much lower.
Yeah.
But his ability to love was, I mean, sexuality is great, but let's not confuse it with love.
No. Okay?
Love lasts a lifetime. Sexuality lasts for whatever it lasts.
A year, and two, gave
her,
three.
Ken gave her love like you would dream of getting love like that. Total acceptance. You know, she was the center of his world. He gave her. I mean, she never found it again. I was just reading something, a letter. Someone wrote an article on her days in Quincy, and she kept writing a friend of hers she grew up with. They were like teenagers together, and she wrote in the 50s about 50s and 60s about Ken. And she just went on and on about how she missed him, how much she loved him, and how she never really appreciated him, and like when he went, it took so much from her. And we're talking 30 years later.
Yeah, well, he sounded like a great guy, and you know it's true. But that seems, what if he, let's, well, we can't speculate.
She would have
dumped him.
Say that again.
I think she would have left him because she needs stuff.
Good. She would have stayed married to him. She would have quit films. It would have been an entirely different story.
You think? Because she was
In fact, Bessie Love was married to one of the other Hawks brothers.
Huh.
And she left Hollywood. She went to England and only did an occasional film there. And she eventually divorced him in the late 30s. But you know, her career was no longer that important to her.
Yeah. Well, that would have been nice, but unfortunately for Mary.
Then we would have lost all those great performances.
Right. And then we would have had... no book, Joe. No book.
And it's also very interesting that a trial like that could have destroyed a career. And she was willing for it to disappear. She had gone to Magnum's, which is a very popular department store, a very high end department store in L.A. and I think it's San Francisco. And she had gotten an agreement that if this didn't work out, they would hire her as a buyer, and she could go to Paris.
Yes,
Paris.
Was in your book.
So she was ready to give it up. She's ready to give it up.
So what I want to say first is when he got that stuff out of Mary, which is awful, don't write a book and don't talk about the people you're married to and people you're having sex with. Just write about what you have for dinner in Jello.
Yeah, right. A date book.
So she was ill, too, during this. And he has kept coming at her and at her. She didn't know what to do. Yeah.
He was relentless. I mean, he was cuckolded. And mind you, this is a man who cuckolded other men. And he was cuckolded, and it was in right. And when you read it, it's much more intense than it being told. And he felt she had made, the term he used was sucker. That was a very popular term in the 30s.
Yes.
That she had made a sucker of him, and he was going to get his pound of flesh. And he hit her every day for weeks. And finally she got a severe case of the flu, and she set up a bed in the library so the baby wouldn't, because the baby was upstairs, wouldn't catch the flu. And he wouldn't let go until she was so weak. She felt the terms she used to explain it in court, I was lit. I was simply, I couldn't fight him.
It's horrible.
So she just didn't give it up because it was convenient.
No, she was so sick and tired and vulnerable.
And it also brought back her father, you know, how she used to give in to her father.
Right.
But over the succeeding years, she realized her mistake. And she was willing to give up everything for it. She was willing to give up everything for Marilyn.
So
and that's what the country, you know, caught on to.
Okay, so we'll start with, so she She filed. She got this from Ann Harding. She got this great lawyer from Actress.
Oh,
she
was very. You did read the book. Yes.
I did.
Ann Harding had a custody case, mm-hmm. I think 2 years before, very famous. And she, her lawyer was a lawyer by the name of Roland Rich Woolley, who also, believe it or not, had also gotten Charlie Chaplin's second wife the largest divorce settlement in history.
$750,000
Right, Lady Grant. And she was a very formidable lawyer. And so he worked out how to do it, and he designed a strategy. It was a brilliant strategy. And to bring it to court and to basically bring up things about Thorpe, his common law marriages, his affairs with Lillian Miles.
It was so funny. What was they called her the tattletale nanny?
Oh no. Okay, during the trial, in 1936, in October. Esther had to turn the baby over. She had 6 months of that she could. She didn't have custody, but she could have the baby for 6 months. She turned the baby over to Thorpe, who was now living in their house. He took over the house, mm-hmm. and he turned the baby. And so he hired a nurse named Nellie Richardson, who would remain with the Esters to the late 30s.
Right.
In any case, Nellie then, when Esther came back she went to New York for the holidays, and when she came back, she reclaimed the baby in June, and then had to pay him for his half of her house
that she paid for
in the first place.
Disgusting.
And she wanted to keep the baby's life consistent,
yes.
So she kept Nellie on, and Nellie became very loyal to the baby and loyal to Esther, because she could see what a good mother she was trying
yes.
to be. Because their philosophy was the same. Discipline, you make sure you have consistency.
Right.
And so she got on the stand and she talked about all of Thorpe's girlfriends.
Which was a riot, serving him breakfast in bed.
Breakfast in bed. And there was one of them, Norma Taylor.
You wrote a lot about her. That was a hoot.
Because Richard Arlen lived across the lake.
Yes.
And Arlen was a big womanizer, too. And Norma was over there and decided she wanted to come over and see Thorpe. Thorpe said, no, I have the baby. But she just came. She was drunk. She wouldn't leave. She took a candlestick and broke windows. She followed him up the bed. By the way, it happens to be Marilyn's first memory.
Wasn't that the turkey that knife? The turkey knife.
She thought it. Marilyn thought it was a knife, and she ran up the stairs after Thorpe into the bathroom. And the only way he could stop her was he pounced on top, because she stuck the knife in him. Was to pounce on top, and they called in the police. And when that came out in the trial, it was sensational. And so the Time magazine called it the tattling nanny.
Yes, I thought that was a riot. And
No, it was. I mean, his attitude was, and you have to understand how men thought in those days. Okay, they can sleep around, but you know they were okay. But if a woman slept around, you know they were Susie Slut.
Well, it was a Madonna whore complex, right?
Right. Okay, exactly. Okay, so what Woolley's plan was? Let's put his skeletons out there, and he wasn't prepared for it. And so he was really blindsided, and he never recovered. He never recovered from that over the course of the trial.
What I want to say is, in the beginning of the trial, what was the public's view? Because it became this big spectacle. Thousands of people were there.
Before the diary came into it, it's just another trial.
Right.
Okay. Then when the diary came in, I had studied years ago, the tabloid press developed by Hearst.
Right.
And here it was in full bloom. I mean, it was the press just said, this is what we want. Because you have to understand, in Hollywood, everything was controlled by the studios.
Right.
You know, their pasts were changed. Their names were changed. The stories were spoon-fed. It was everything was to make the star in real life the star you saw on the screen.
Right.
And nice. There was no affair. They were beyond reproach.
Morality
Suddenly,
clause.
You've got the
right.
real thing.
Right.
Suddenly you've got the real story. You've got it right there. Other women, George Kaufman, this, and it was like it was the dream come true. And
yeah,
they just fed on it.
But
and so once the diary came into the picture, that's when it really, and what also happened was that somebody had written, see, Asta's diary was more romantic in its writing.
Right.
It was not in any way pornographic.
X-rated. Yeah,
no way.
X-rated, yeah.
But someone printed, and it was accepted as another, a forged diary that was totally pornographic. It had ratings, how good lovers were. So the two became fused in the public's mind, and they were waiting for, they would find out who was the best lover. Was it Clark Gable? Was it I'm trying to think of another big star at the time. Was it William Powell? You know, it was like, and the press just fed into this, and it was so impossible that Astor, the press was so impossible that Astor, she was working on a film called Dogsworth.
Great
giving
film.
Probably one of the best performances of her career. And she was working on that film. She stayed in the studio in her dressing room and only went to the trial and went right back.
Okay.
And she never read any of this stuff because it was beyond control. And then Thorpe was reading it, and he made an announcement. None of this other stuff is true. But nobody believed him.
Of course not. But what I mean is, were the public with Mary or not? Because this is what really gets me.
This is fascinating. After the trial was over, you would think her career was over. And the reception at Dodsworth, when her name appeared or her voice appeared, they applauded.
Yes.
What happened was that the salaciousness, you know, his and hers sort of you know,
canceled each other out.
And what they saw was a mother fighting for a child. And you must remember, 3 or 4 years before, these mother love films with Marie Dressler, with even Ruth Chatterton, where the mother sacrificed everything. The Sin of Madeleine Corday.
Helen Hayes.
And these were immensely popular. And now this is the real thing. She was willing to sacrifice everything for her child. And in the end, the American public was with her.
But I got to ask you, Tom.
At that premiere, they were shouting at her, you know, good for you, Mary.
Yeah.
Good for you.
And she cried, and I think that's beautiful.
She couldn't believe it.
But I want to say this about...
And it's interesting. One last thing. Her career was bigger after the trial than it was before.
I bet. But I just want to talk about Dodsworth, and I want to mention this wonderful woman who I am so intrigued by, Ruth Chatterton. Everybody, she was doing the movie while the trial was going on, and Ruth Chatterton asked her, is anyone going with you? And she said no. And Ruth asked.
Just to be there with her.
You
could look at there's someone supporting you.
What a thing, because other friends, and I'm sorry, Florence Eldridge came. I'm sorry, honey, a little too late. I think she was waiting to see how the public reacted, and then she shows up. Ruth Chatterton was there from day one.
Or she could have been out of town. I tried to research that.
Yeah, I wonder what that was about. But
I went to her. I contacted her husband's biographer to find out, and she didn't know either. She could have been out of town.
Or she was a chicken chow mein.
No, she was a very, no. She was very close to Astor. When Hawks died, it was at the March's house.
Yes.
That she stayed, and she was always angry because Astor cut off she was friends with Thalberg, Norma Shearer, she was friends with everybody. She cut them all off. And Florence was very angry at her about this. You're not going to cut me off as a friend. So I think Florence was just out of town, to be honest with you.
Oh,
she's
so
a very good
friend. What do you mean?
And Marilyn even remembers her as a good friend of her mother's.
I like Florence Eldridge, but what do you mean? Mary cut them off as friends?
No. After Hawks died, they reminded her of Ken. She never went back to the house.
I see. Yeah,
she never went back to the house. She stopped dealing with her. She was very good friends with Howard. She was very good friends with Thalberg's
Norma Shearer.
Howard was married to Norma Shearer's sister, so they were very good friends with Thalberg. There was a whole group of them, and she just cut herself completely off from them.
Well, I can understand.
And Florence refused to accept that. Florence was a good, faithful friend.
Good. And I love Ruth Chatterton. I think she's an amazing woman.
And there is a wonderful book on Chatterton by a writer by the name of Scott O'Brien. about Chatterton. This was a fantastic woman. She produced her own plays when she was on Broadway. When she came to Hollywood, she was a reporter. She was a crime reporter until she finally got a part in a film. She worked out a contract. She gave up acting for a year to become one of the leading aviatrices. She was a flyer. She was not scared of anybody. And if she didn't like you, she would tell you what she... Scott's book is so good.
I've got to read that. I want to read it.
After you read it, you can order the ebook. I don't think it's in hardcover anymore. You can order the ebook on Amazon.
Yeah.
And for a year she took off from flying, and Ruth Chatterton wasn't scared of anybody.
I love
her. And she realized she was getting older. Okay, she was playing like the older woman in Dodsworth, in which she gives her greatest performance.
Oh my God, I loved her, and she wanted to play it meaner. I loved
her. She wanted to play it less sympathetic, and
yes.
She had fights with Wyler. No one fought Wyler like she did. No one fought Wyler like
but
she
what
did.
What a performance! She deserved an Academy Award for that.
She was great in that movie, but after that she said they're going to have me playing old women. Forget about it. So she went back to the stage, produced her own plays, did television. She was truly an extraordinary woman, a woman libba before there was.
Yeah, I got to get that book because I didn't know. I didn't know until I read your book. Yeah,
it's so good. It's not that it's tough reading. It's not as demanding. It's like he gives you everything, but it slowly builds it. So, but as I said to him over and over, you know, because we together call her Ruthie. But as I said to him, after I read that book, I knew who this woman was. I could tell you what she would say. The research is a superb research. His research was incredible on that.
Okay, so let's get back to Mary, our Mary girl. So she does a trial. It becomes this big, huge thing. There are people, I started sweating reading the book because you're telling how hot it was. In California,
oh, no, the time, degrees, yeah.
Everybody's sweating. They're taking the judge taking off his robe. People are trying to get in there. Guys, the vendors are selling hot dogs and popcorn and everything in the hallways.
She called it a circus.
It was a circus. It was so. But through it all, Mary's main concern was not to get those diaries. The judge actually put an end. He said, let's stop. We got to stop doing this. This is taking too long. I'm worried. He went to see the kid, right?
See, the judge was trying to be fair.
Right.
But on the other hand, he was seeing this was turning into such a travesty. Mm-hmm. And what about the baby? And you know, there were issues about the baby would have to live with this the rest of her life, with all the stuff coming out. And finally, what happened was that Thorpe's attorney was trying to get the diary was not submitted as it could not be submitted as evidence on the technicality, but he was trying to imply things that were in it. And there was a whole day of useless testimony. And the judge finally said, that's it. Listen, we're going to settle this today, and that's it. And that was it. And he said, my job here is not to feed the press. My job here is to protect this child. And stuff, and that's exactly what he did. In fact, I asked Marilyn. I read her an article where the judge said, "I hope someday that this child will be grateful for what we've done." And she said, "Yes, I am grateful for what he did and stuff." And then after the trial, he made it very clear when things were settled, if this happened again, he would have the right to take the baby away from both of them. So he made it very clear to them this was to stop right now.
Well, they
right
were
now.
Exactly, but they were trying to settle it, her ex-husband's lawyers wanted those diaries. And
Thorpe
he said,
wanted the diary in case she brought up another suit. She wanted the diary because her friends were in it. She wanted them embarrassed and stuff. And so the judge finally locked it away, and it went into a bag vault, and it wasn't open until after Marilyn was 21 when everything was moot. And then, in fact, I have the letter where Astor agrees, writes Thorpe, because he's agreed on the phone to have the diaries destroyed. And so they both agreed to destroy the diaries and get rid of them. And that was in 1952, I think.
What's funny then, that after that ended and Mary got, you know, she was great in Dodsworth. This is a fabulous movie. Everybody was great in Dodsworth. But Mary was so warm and lovely.
I'm interrupting you, but it's also interesting that you have to understand this was a very shy woman. And to do that in courtroom was impossible. So what she did was, it wasn't that she wasn't being sincere, but what she did was she used the character that she was playing in Dodsworth, which was she's considered to be a complete person,
right.
A complete woman, calm. And she used that when she was in that courtroom, she was imagining herself to be Edith Courthright,
right?
And she met, and that got her through the. It saved her. She said it saved her. It really saved her.
Well, that was a blessing she was doing that movie at the time, because then she had Ruth Chatterton. And she had that whole character.
And if you see her in the film, she's stunning in that. There's a scene where she begs him not to go, but she says, you have to go. I cry every time I see it.
It's such a
girl. And then the last shot in the movie,
she's
sitting there. The character in the film was sort of like a wanderer. She was like an American.
She didn't know where she belonged. Yeah.
Right. And then she gets in this relationship with Walter Houston, and suddenly life has come to her. She's alive again. And now when he leaves her, we see her again, and she's sort of just roaming, like walking around. You can see she's desolate.
Yes.
She's like, and then she goes to her porch or whatever it is, and she looks out, and Houston's coming back. And she smiles and she comes to life.
It was beautiful.
And it's interesting that Wyler always took 10, 15 takes. That take he printed on the first take. And she said, he says, you can't do better than that. And however she got to that character, she really got to the heart of that character, and that character saved her.
She was great. And all of them
were great. It's a favorite role. It's a favorite role.
Yes. And also, so then afterwards, she got some really great films. She got, what'd she get? She got Maltese Falcon.
What happened was that she finished this awful contract with Columbia.
Yeah.
She always took contracts because they paid her high money. She was making the highest amount of money of any, what they call featured player, anybody under the title. She made a decision because she had been a star in Silence, and then she did work for a year because of the transition, and then she said, I'm not going to disappear, so let me take my name off of above the title, and so the film is not a Mary Astor film. Mary Astor is in the film, so the film can stink, but if I'm good, I'm okay. So what happened was that she was only looking in the contract, she was looking for more money.
Yeah.
So what happened was after the trial, David Selznick's brother, Myron, who was the best agent in Hollywood, represented her, and he put her into, made her independent. So she, for example, the following year, she made Prisoner of Zender for David Selznick, and she made more money for making that one film that she made in a whole year's contract. And she stayed independent until she went to MGM in, I think, 43, and she did some of her best roles. She did Maltese Falcon. She did...
The Great Lie.
The Great Lie, for which she won an Oscar.
She was fabulous.
She did The Palm Beach Story, which is fabulous.
She was adorable.
She did some other films that weren't as good. But you see, the funny thing about Astor was, unlike a Betty Davis... she never fought for roles. The way she got The Great Lie was that Betty Davis called her up and said, you know how to play the piano? We need someone who knows how to play the piano. At least looks like they know how to play the piano. She never fought for a single role except for that one she did at the end of career with Van Heflin. I can't remember
the
name right now.
An act of violence.
Yeah. Where she worked with, she was in the middle of this big MGM film called remake of Little Women, and she was bored to death in it. Oh, she was just a costume.
Working
with the kids, and it was another one of these mothers.
Or 40-year-old Joan June Allison.
Right, exactly.
Who's supposed to be a kid? Okay. Yeah,
It was the second time she was Margaret O'Brien's mother. Okay, and she went to Fred Zinnemann and she worked out the part. She went and bought the dress in a department store. She put stains on it. First time I saw the movie, I didn't even know it was Mary Astor.
I didn't either.
A down and out prostitute.
She and had long hair. She was hefty.
Right.
No makeup,
terrible lighting. And stuff, and she was fabulous. In fact, if you remember the end of the film, she even came up with these wonderful bits where she puts on that hat and she says, "Well, I'm leaving town. I had enough." That's all Mary Astor. That role was entirely created by Mary Astor.
She did a fabulous job. That's a great film.
Melvin Leroy ran into her in that costume and said, "Mary, you have to do something. You look terrible. What are they doing? You have to go to the costume. What are they doing to you?" He couldn't believe it was her. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Let's talk about Mary, because she did age pretty teased, you know, I think a lot of the actresses did. Bette Davis, if you look at 40 today as 40 then, Mary drank a lot.
Oh, drank. She, again, her marriages were not the best. The roles were getting, MGM did not give her any challenges. So the acting, she was getting older, and so she started drinking. And again, when you have problems when you're younger, and if they're not really dealt with, it begins to really manifest itself as you get older.
Yes.
And alcohol is one way to deal with it. So by 45, 46, 47, she was beginning to gain weight. Now understand something. When Astor drank, she never drank on the set. She never drank when she was making a movie.
Right.
When she wasn't making a movie, she was very disciplined. But it had its toll. It was a very difficult time for her. Her daughter was growing up. Her third husband was another alcoholic.
Who was he? We should tell people who he was that she married this other guy. He was some, and she had a son.
She had a son by her third husband.
Right.
Del Campo, Tono, who was a beautiful kid. He and Marilyn were very, very, very close. In fact, when Astor had to go back to New York after her film career was over and she got well again, she had to go to New York. Basically, Tono moved in with Marilyn and her husband. And as a teenager, Marilyn and her husband were her was his surrogate parents. They basically raised Tono. They were very, very close.
You know what's a very, great very picture? The picture of Marilyn's wedding. And Marilyn's face, because Mary Astor is going in for the kill for her husband, smooching her husband, and the face of the daughter is priceless.
It's interesting. Marilyn didn't want me to use the picture, and I said, I have to use it. So you look on your face is fantastic. And she said to me, she didn't want me to use it because there my mother was again hogging the show.
Exactly. That's what it looked like to me. And she's like, oh, God. You know, I thought that was a fabulous picture.
And you have to understand, for Marilyn, the only movie she likes is Charlie Chaplin. She doesn't understand why people look at old movies. She had been up for some parts, and she just couldn't. She didn't want. She just said, "Forget about it. I'm not going to
have the discipline." Yeah,
right. And stuff. And she went and had her kids. And so Hollywood has no mystery for her. Hollywood has no interest for her. And I say to her, "How could it? You have Tyrone Power on your couch. You've got Humphrey Bogart in the chair over there. You've got this one there. You've got that one."
Yeah, it's like home.
When she was a little kid, she went to MGM when her mother couldn't get a babysitter. And one day, her mother meets Marlena Dietrich.
Dietrich
was dressed in that gold costume for Kismet.
Yes.
And, I mean, this was one of the most glamorous women in the world, one of the most glamorous costumes ever.
She was.
And Marilyn is standing with her mother. Yeah. And finally, after about 5 minutes, "Mom, are you done yet? Can we go?"
It's so funny. Because I had an interview. I love her dearly. Claude Rains' daughter, Jessica. And
oh, I love it. Yeah.
Do you know Jessica?
No. I've read stuff that she's
fabulous.
That she's written about her, that Bette Davis's relationship with Claude.
Well, Ray. You should listen to my podcast with Jessica. She's a riot and she's fun. But you know what? She was like, I don't know. She's so cute. You got to love her. And she gave me what she could. And she was basically like you said, he was my father. I thought he was a farmer. Blah. You know, it's not like, oh God, they're these great
people.
They
could have been a factory.
Right.
She saw them as actors. They did their job. There was no glamour to what she saw.
No. She met Joan Crawford, everybody, you know.
Marilyn was best friends with Spencer Tracy's daughter. And both of them never talked about movies at all. She was best. She when she went to school, she went to a boarding school.
Yeah.
She and Spencer Tracy's daughter were her name wasn't Tracy. I can't remember the name. Were absolutely
Susan?
The best friends. And they never talked about movies. She never went to. I mean,
because
she,
it would be nauseating as a kid. Because it's like ho hum, and you know your parents are pretty self involved. You know, it's a whole different thing.
She said the worst times were to go on the set. And you go onto the set, and you're sitting there, and you're waiting, and it's boring, and it's hot. They didn't have air conditioning in those days.
Yeah.
And it was just, this is glamorous?
Yeah.
This is glamorous? Let me go listen to my Diana Durbin records.
That's what I remember. So let's get to some of the ends of their story. So the father, he ends up never marrying
He married again.
But not her.
Wait. This is a great story.
Yeah.
He married a woman much younger than him who cheated on him, and that ended. And then he also had several girlfriends at the time who got along with the wife. then he married another wife who was a patient and was alcoholic, and Thorpe was a very, very good man. You have to understand, in this circumstances, he was in the worst circumstances possible, so he kind of comes out as a villain. But he was a very, very good and a wonderful doctor.
Well,
and
Mary so still went to him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mary still
yes.
went to him.
Well into the 40s. Well into the 40s.
That's
no question
amazing.
About it. Well into the 40s.
Because she hit early menopause, and then she had the fibroids. She had to have the hysterectomy and the whole
But at
nine.
That point, she was seeing other doctors.
Of course.
He was a superb doctor.
Yeah.
He was one of the best doctors in town. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah, I believe you, I found that to be interesting that she still had him as her doctor.
Especially the examinations,
yeah.
right?
Oh, yeah.
And Marilyn, in the 50s, when Marilyn had her baby, guess who delivered all her babies? Her father was her doctor until he died in 77.
She got married very
young. He was a great
young.
Doctor, and he was a really good man. He was just, as I say, nobody's perfect. He, you know, he was very guarded. He liked women. What can I tell you? He had libido. In any case, so he married this wife who had been an alcoholic. He married her afterwards, and they lived until he died. But he tend to be someone very short-tempered, and it could be very abusive. The only thing Marilyn remembers back about him negatively is that when he started yelling. When he started yelling, she said she wanted to be in another room.
Yeah.
And even in the trial, remember, Astor says, you didn't want to be around when he started yelling.
Yeah.
And stuff. But she said, Marilyn said he had migraines.
Mm.
And so, you know, that could have impacted. And also, her father, like her mother, was a perfectionist. He could not do anything less than the best. And so you put all of it together, you know, he was a man. He was no worse or no better than anyone else. But in any case, he did remarry, and he kept himself very trim. He listened to exercise. He eventually, to his sister, Clara was a leading exponent of yoga, and he took up yoga. In fact, she wrote a book, and he wrote the intro to the book. And he was in his own way an amazing man. He just didn't want his private life in the newspapers. That's all.
Well, that's amazing, because he's the one who pushed it there in the first place. But
again,
and then he wrote that page. What about the Daily News in New York? I was married to a movie star, whatever.
Right, I was married to an actress. But again, he needed money. He wasn't able to pay off his lawyer. In fact, I have the last bill. Gabrielle sent me all this stuff, and I have the last bill. He didn't pay off the lawyer for the following summer. He didn't really have the money. He never had that much. Even Marilyn said he had his own practice. It was in the First National Building.
Yeah.
He kept that practice for like 40 years. He got a secretary. He did his own, who basically did the billing. He did everything else. Did all the paperwork. He did work for people gratis. He was his own man. Franklin Thorpe was his own man. He was not going to be part of a machine and he did it on his own terms. But he never had a lot of money. I mean, money wasn't a big deal to him. You know, I think his freedom was.
Yeah.
When he was married to Astor, they lived very well. They bought the yacht, they all this other stuff. But after it was over, it was, you know, it was fine with him. I mean, he was a very interesting. He was a very interesting man. And Marilyn, you know, loves him dearly. Has the most fondest memories of him.
That's great. But I was going to ask you one thing. We should get to Mary. And Mary's thing, she did the movies. She got very depressed when she was menopausal. Then she found out that she was ill. So she kind of just hid out for a while. She married the third guy.
She married the third guy in 45.
Yes, and she had her son. And then who?
No, that was the second husband. She had if you look at the film Midnight, if you look closely, you can see she's pregnant with Tony.
And that she was in that with John Barrymore, right?
John Barrymore. Oh, that's an interesting story in itself, too. All right. Anyway, and then so she, Del Campo was like a playboy. He left and joined the RAF or the British part of the RAF. So he was gone and got divorced, and she never got a dime from him for Tono. See, Tono never had a father.
Yeah.
So that's why when Frank and Marilyn took him, he wanted to stay there. because Frank was a, you know, Frank Rowe was a very good, was you know, he was really, he took care of him. He took, Tono and him were very, very close. And so then she married him, she remarried him, Esther remarried in 45. She left, she begged out of her MGM contract because she was in a menopausal depression. And without work, she had nothing, so she got more depressed, and so she drank. Marilyn was telling me that she was taking like Benzedrine just to get up in the morning, or one of these kinds of drugs and stuff. And then she went in for examination, and she had fibroids, which could have led to, she could have gotten, I mean, she really was, she had no money. She was living off of
the fourth husband. We should talk about the fourth husband who ripped her off. He did bad investments.
It wasn't that he ripped her off. It was that he made terrible investments because he lost his own money as well. So, and stuff. He just was not.
Who was he? What was he about? Was he just a regular Joe?
He came from a wealthy family, and he was. I think his family were brokers. I really don't know the truth. I really didn't do that much research on him because it wasn't really part of my story and stuff. But and it was not even a sexual relationship. It was more of
really.
A friendship. Yeah,
Marilyn, to be with. He drank a lot too.
Marilyn said that when she came home from school. She would have like one weekend every month.
Uh-huh.
It was like they couldn't stand it. She and Tono would just stay in the pool all day. They had these parties. She even said, I got married. Well, it's in the interview I have on the website. She said she got married because she just wanted to get out of a house of drunks.
And how old was she? She was only 17, right?
She had to wait till her 18th birthday. She asked and wanted to go to college. She said, college is just not for me. No way. She wanted to have children, and she had her first baby, Francis. She had Francis, I think, at 51. In fact, Francis is now I just wrote Francis. She's now she's going to Europe for a couple of weeks.
Good. Hi, Francis. Have a good time. And all you guys, I think all those Astors are fabulous. So they gave you so much info, and you have this great website, too. But, okay, so let's just kind of wrap up Mary's existence. So she then gets divorced from this guy. She is broke. So she has to get money from...
I'll give you the story. Look at this. She's broke. She borrows money. She goes into a bank and borrows like $500 so she can go to New York and appear in a play. There's some this and that. Uh-huh. But she appears in Broadway. She does another play. Suddenly she's getting television work and she's appearing in television. And it's interesting. She's making like $5,000 a show, but she's doing like four or five of them a year. So she's making a decent living. She eventually gets on her feet financially. She's asked to write this book. It's my story. She's given a nice advance. She buys this house in Malibu. She's very happy. She's prouder of the book than she is of anything she's ever done. And she decides to write a novel. It turns out to be very successful. And so she decides in 1964 to give up acting. And she does her last film, which is Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. She only has a 5-minute part.
Jewel Mayhew.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it's the best thing in the movie.
She was fabulous.
Everything in that film, everything you see her, was all figured out by her. And she gave you Tennessee William in this gothic
horror film. Wonderful.
She was extraordinary. And she said it was a nice way to go out. And so she sold the house.
And with Betty Davis. Great line.
Betty Davis told the director, leave her alone. Leave her alone. Just leave her alone and let her do it, and you're going to be amazed. And they were, and stuff. So then she finished that. She did her last TV role was, I think it was in The Defenders that year. No, it was, it was Ben Casey. Ben Casey or Dr. Kildare, one of them. And she said, that's it, I'm going to be a writer. But a writer could not support her like an actress could, so she had to sell the house in Malibu and move to an apartment. Eventually, she went to Mexico. She was continually writing. She produced, I think, five or six books. And her last published book was she wrote in Mexico was this fabulous book called Life on Film, which was a wonderful book about her acting career and the people she worked with and this and that. It's absolutely the best.
Can you get it anymore?
It's not in print anymore. I actually called the publisher and they have no plan to print it, but you can buy it you can buy it on eBay if you want, and it's like $50 or $40 or something. I had wanted to put it on, I put like my story on the website. I had wanted to put this on the website, but I just didn't have the energy to type it all up. So if not, I would have put it on the website. So that got published, but she got sick in Mexico, and she had to come back. She lived with Tono for a while. She tried her apartment by herself. but she was just in and out with doctors and stuff because she had COPD. Marilyn said she smoked like a chimney.
Emphysema came.
She was still drinking. Then she finally went to the motion picture country home. Because she had set up annuities, she was able to pay her way through there. So she had a little bungalow, and so she was trying to finish her last novel, which she did, but nobody wanted it. And then she just waited around. And for a woman like her, it was very difficult. She had a stroke. She didn't want to talk about movies. And so for the last 7 years of her life, 6 years of her life, it was a very difficult time for her. And in 1985, she, she had, I think it was congestive heart failure. So she went to the hospital where she remained for 2 years. And that's where she died.
Wow. What year did she die?
She died in September 1987.
Oh, I thought she died a lot earlier than that. Wow.
Marilyn said to me, the way she treated her body between alcohol and smoking, she's surprised she lasted that long. You know, I mean, she had a very strong body and really determination. I mean, to the end, there's a film of hers that I really like. The part is not big, but she's fabulous in it, called Desert Fury. And Marilyn told me, and I always liked that part. I always liked that role. Marilyn told me that that part was the closest to her mother. And it was a strong-willed, determined woman, blah, blah. And to the last of her life, the character, we don't even call it Desert Fury. We call it Fritzy. To the end of her life, Mary Astor was Fritzy. The way she was, when she went, her daughter went to see her the last time. Her daughter hadn't seen her in a while. They had been estranged.
Yeah, that's such a shame.
They were very different. They were very different people.
Yeah.
And so she went to see her, and she went, "Mom, I really missed you." And Astor looked, basically on her deathbed, her deathbed. She was dead a month later. She said, "Listen, you know, let's not get sentimental and stuff." And
sad.
She was Bogey called her a dame.
Yeah, she was a dame.
She's basically a dame.
And she's a tough broad. She was a tough broad.
Listen, I have so much. I mean, what kept me through the book was Astor.
She was fabulous. I think she's a wonderful. She was an interesting character. She was a strong woman, yet, you know, weak. But what happened after her fourth divorce? She just said, "I don't need love no more. No men. Dem's gone."
She had one character. Her 58 books, she changed names and changed things. But she was always looking for a guy to take. She was always looking for that father.
But did she still go out with guys after her fourth marriage?
Eventually she gave up.
When did she give up?
Oh, I would say probably when she started writing. Marilyn said she became very isolated. And you have to call to see her. And then she'd only, you know, I mean, she was writing. Marilyn would come over, clean up the house for her.
Yeah.
This is when she was in Malibu. And what happened was she had a cat named Missy, and she hadn't been drinking for many years. And she saw the cat get killed by a dog.
Oh.
And that killed her. And that's when she started drinking.
But that was like her best friend.
It was off and on. I'm sorry.
You go on.
I don't know where I was going.
You wrote it, and about the irony that how hard Mary fought for Marilyn, yet she was intolerant. Marilyn said she could never be herself with her mother. She could never be who she was with her mother.
She was her father.
Right.
Mary Astor was a version of her father.
Right.
She was raised by this autocrat. And that's all she knew. I mean, you cannot suddenly become somebody else.
No, but
you're raised by a parent.
No.
And, you know, the horrible thing is, and I see that in myself, is I looked at how I was with my kids, and suddenly I said, "Holy moly, I'm my father."
Yeah, you know? It's scary.
And stuff. And so she tried her best. And remember, Astor was working. She was like a working mom today. So she wasn't a hands-on mom.
And she was also working 6 days a week. That was the thing.
12 hours a day.
Yeah.
So the servants did what she told them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so she created consistency. And Marilyn was like scared of her mother. And Marilyn never thought she met her mother's approval. But the truth was, the only two people I believe that Mary Astor loved all her life were her daughter and her son. But she could not show it. She could not do it in certain ways.
How sad.
And so Marilyn was caught. And then as Marilyn got older, Mary Astor, you see, when Frank married Marilyn, he essentially took Marilyn away, and he took her baby away. And it was like she could never forgive him. I mean, you know what I mean? You love this person so much. And so he could never forgive Frank and didn't like Frank. And so Marilyn said, why should we even visit you if you don't like Frank? You know what I'm saying? So it was like nothing was good enough. Her mother was critical. It was just, her mother became difficult.
Yeah.
And so they became estranged. But they loved each other. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
It was just they couldn't get along. And Marilyn is like, she's 86 now, and has more energy than a 20-year-old intellectually. And stuff.
Well, she had smart parents. She had two bright parents.
Yeah. Marilyn is someone who is not school educated. I mean, she went to a very good private school, and she had a year of college, but she's very well read. I mean, she's reading philosophy now.
Good for her.
And stuff. Metaphysics. She's someone who doesn't believe in history. She believes you have to live in the present, which is what she does.
Which is good. Well, you know, I guess she has to, but. You know, the history.
86 years old, you better.
Yeah, you got to live now. She lives
every moment.
Where does she live?
As every moment.
Where is she living?
I mean, Marilyn does not dwell in the past. She does not, you know, think of it as the good old days or anything like that. She just wished things would be better in the world. And stuff.
I'm with Marilyn on that.
But she's extraordinary. But in that way, she's like her mother. But the fascinating thing is she writes just like a mother. You get it. I've seen letters, Astor's letters, and I've seen Marilyn's letters, and they're the same. She writes just like her mother.
Wow.
It's like, it's amazing. And she's tough like her mother. She's very strong. She's one of the strongest people I know.
Good for her. That's and just, stuff. But let me tell you guys.
Astor was a great mother. She was a great mother.
And she loved her daughter, and she did a brave thing to put herself out there. And I am a big fan of Mary Astor as an actress, and, you know, as a person, her strength was, you know, I just think...
With her limitations.
Yes.
She accomplished a great deal.
She sure did. And she got through it. And, you know, nobody's perfect. And I see, you know, Anne Harding fought for her daughter. And it's ironic how her daughter could not stand her mother and wrote really horrible things about Anne
Harding.
Betty
Davis' daughter. Betty Davis' B.D.
B.D., who I read.
Beatrix's daughter.
Did you read the book? The B.D. Book? It was a free joke. It was such a joke. Oh, my mother was overbearing.
She basically, what she was doing in the book was doing what she should have done in therapy.
Yes, she should have.
We all have resentment.
Of course we do. Our parents are not perfect.
We all feel slighted.
They do what they can.
You do not write a book until you've worked all of that out.
Yeah.
Because it's all going to be one-sided and basically... Marilyn had already worked out her stuff about her mother.
She didn't write Mary, dearest, which is a good thing.
She would never do that.
Of course not.
In fact, she didn't want me to write my book. She says, my mother's in her grave. Let her rest in peace. And stuff and all this stuff. But when she read the book, you're going to love this. I sent her the book when it was done, and I asked her to fact check it. Marilyn didn't just fact check it. She proofread it. Corrected the spelling, corrected the sentences.
Did she like it?
Oh, she loved it. She loves the book. She loves the book.
It's a great book, people.
She loves the book because it made her mother. It was like she said, it showed my mother to be who she was.
Yes, it's a great book.
She wasn't perfect.
No.
She wasn't perfect. She was flawed like the rest of us. But, you know, you judge people by their best, not their worst.
Yes.
And stuff. And she and I believe that Astor just she wasn't into BS.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when she was with friends, she just did sit and gossip. She may talked about people, but she analyzed.
Yeah.
She wanted intelligent people. She wanted intelligent conversations.
Well, she certainly didn't come across like adult. She played. You looked at her, and she could not play dumb. You know, she was just not the kind of a person.
You got to look at her. You got to look at Desert Fury. She's in Desert Fury. The other thing
I've seen it, but haven't seen it for years. I'll have to check it out.
No, because they don't have it on. I had to get a European copy to a European Blu-ray. But if you look at her in Meet Me in St. Louis, okay, which is she plays the ideal mother.
Yes.
Because Minnelli worked and rehearsed, she was able to perfect the part, and she's perfection. It's like it looks like effortless. It's an effortless performance. And the piano piece, that was because of her father, she stopped singing and playing the piano, and that was the first time she had sung in a long, long time. But she played that piece, when the family gathered around after after there was a problem, and Leon Ames sat next to her and singing, that was her actually singing. That was the only time I think she ever sung on screen.
Well, it was a beautiful movie. She really is wonderful. And I think she was wonderful in all of it. I loved her in Red Dust. I loved her in Red Dust.
I wrote a piece, and I said to her, okay, one of my favorite directors is William Wellman. Mm-hmm. William Wellman was fond of saying, I only work for the money. Whoever offered me more money, that's who I went to.
Yeah.
But he said, out of the 100 films I made, 80 of them are crap. 20 of them aren't bad. 10 of them are the best that ever came out of that town. And so I said, okay, look at Astor. She only worked for the money. And I found the 10 movies. Dodsworth, what was the one that you brought up that where she played the prostitute? Definitely
Fritzy. An Act of Violence.
Cynthia, which she did the same year as Fritzy. Mm-hmm. And she played Elizabeth Taylor's mother. And you could see the love in every scene on her face. She's fabulous in it. She, of course, a Palm Beach Story.
She was so good in
Dodsworth.
That.
She did 10 great performance, and what's fascinating, and of course, Maltese Falcon, she's incredible. But what's fascinating, in fact, if you want, I can send you. I have in 71, she did an oral history, and it was sent to me, and she talked about working on the Maltese Falcon, and it's much more than it's in the book.
Oh, I'd love to. She's working with love them. To see it.
But
yeah,
it's the only time she ever did an oral history, and the thing is, but of those 10 films, she's fabulous. And there are other actresses that were much bigger stars. Norma Shearer, for example, was massive. Who heard of Norma Shearer today?
Precoce. She was Precoce. Yeah.
Yeah, because, again, it's Mary Astor is for whatever reason. And I mean, I was talking to Molly Haskell. I sent Molly Haskell a copy of the book. And she was raving on and on about Astor. And she said, her husband, Andrew Saris, raved on and on about Mary Astor. I mean, you know, when she was at her best, she was the best.
She was the best. And I have to say.
And let me just say one other thing. Okay. A total professional. When she was on the set, she would make sure that if she had to pick up a cup, there'd be no problem. She'd bring up the property man. So when the director came and shot, one take. Marilyn used to say she was known as One Take Mary. And studios, directors, they loved her. She was a total professional.
And there are so many people who love her. She has that millions of fans still. And I got to tell you, Joe, your book, I read twice now.
Thank you.
And because I read it, you know, when it first came out, and then I just reread it because I was going to talk to you. And, you know, it just reminded me what a great book it was. So I think everybody, this is written by Joseph Egan. Joe, you've been a great guest. And I want to tell you, if you want it, you know, you can get it on Audible. You can get it on Amazon. I'll link you up to everything about Joe. Joe will give me all his stuff.
If people want, they can send me a copy and I'll autograph.
You're swell.
You can contact me on the Purple Diaries website. The email comes directly to me.
Okay.
And I'll be if you want to send me the book, I'll be happy to sign it.
Joe, can you do me a favor and link me?
Anything you want.
Yeah, send me all that stuff so I can put it when I put this out. You know, I'll link them to the Purple Diaries.
I'll send you the oral history. Sure. I'm gonna. No, I haven't had time to put it on the site, but
I do.
More people read it, the better.
I want the site as well. So just send me
and
that
picture,
so I can put that down.
I have to send you the picture from
yes.
The
so I want to tell you people, Joseph will be on again because he's a Hollywood historian. He knows classic movies, and he's a pleasure and a doll. And I want you guys to check out The Purple Diaries, Mary Astor and the Most Sensational Hollywood Scandal of the 1930s. We Love Our Mary by Joseph Egan. Fabulous book. Can't say
it enough.
I
don't think it's at Barnes & Noble's again, but you can get it on Amazon.
Oh, yeah. I've already linked that to it, but I will link it again. And, Joe, you were great. All I can say is you were fabulous. And I really, you know you're Hollywood, so we will talk about other juicy Hollywood stuff at another time. I hope you will be my guest
anytime,
again.
Listen, just anytime you want. You know, you after all, you only live 5 blocks away from me.
Ha! 5 blocks. Hell's Kitchen.
Years.
Hell's Kitchen. You call it Clinton. Now it's like proudly stated, Hell's Kitchen. Yeah. Yeah, the kids love it now. The kids have moved here. Like, yeah, man, we live in Hell's Kitchen. It's like, kid, you don't know nothing. Anyway, Joseph, you were a delight. And everybody, thank you to listening to True Tales. That was going to be the name. True Stories of Tinseltown. Love it and love Joe. And you will love this book. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye. And thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You were great. Bye.